Welcome to The Dialectic. I'm Barash Booth.
And I'm The Wasp.
We are here today to discuss Israel and Gaza, Israel and Hamas. We are not doing our podcast, our long-promised podcast on woke ideology in American campuses, though we will in the future. We are not doing the rise of the far right, which will also follow. Today we are focused on what's going on in Israel and why, and what does this mean in the immediate and the medium term, and perhaps even the long term. So Glenn, over to you. What is going on?
You gave me the easy topics. Well, I think I'll take us back to when we were 12 years old or 10 years old, when we were first being taught how to write or approach an issue and do an analytical paper. And there are the basic questions, but only three or so of which, three of the five ones will be addressed: why, what, and how. But we'll take it from a strategic perspective to address those questions. And I think attempt to put in context and then look forward a bit. So why is the chaos, the invasion, the war, and all the suffering happening in Gaza, in Israel, now? Now, we know there's been an invasion. Why has this occurred? Well, the stated objective by Bibi Netanyahu, the prime minister of Israel, is to, quote, destroy Hamas, unquote. That's an understandable objective. In ways, frankly, I think that the general public everywhere is unaware of or undervalues given recent events, but in particular, the nature of Hamas. Now, is that objective achievable? I'll talk about it in a little bit. So why the invasion? Hamas's charter. And we really must take Hamas at its word, as well as we should take jihadists and Islamicists at their word, and most political leaders, frankly. The stated objective, the reason for being of Hamas, is to destroy Israel as a state and kill every Jew, certainly in Israel, or at least push them to the sea or out. That's a minimum objective. It's actually much more millennial than that, and apocalyptic. Although some leaders have been mealy-mouthed and tried to step back from their statements in their charter, the implications are, well, they aren't just implied. The stated objectives are to destroy the Jews.
The feeling very quickly, Glenn, can I read exactly one of the phrases they've used? In the original 1988 charter, Hamas stated that there is no solution for the Palestinian problem except by jihad. Then it went on to say, the day that enemies usurp part of Muslim land, jihad becomes the individual duty of every Muslim. Hamas condemned the historic Oslo Accords, and it has also said that international peace proposals and conferences are but a waste of time and vain endeavors. Over to you, Glenn.
Now, the Israeli governments, not just Bibi Netanyahu's, but the Israeli governments for decades have calculated that, or worked to make the reality, that Hamas and all other existential enemies of Israel could be contained so that Israel would be secure, and that so that Israel would not have any existential threat. That is, has been for decades literally the case. It's terrible when a terrorist attack kills anybody, blows up a bus in Tel Aviv, or slits someone's throat in a kibbutz, or anything, any place in the world. But horrific as those individual acts are, they aren't remotely existential threats. The Israeli calculation and policy of containing so that Israel would be secure has been largely successful. However, that has also under Bibi Netanyahu's governments in particular, which have empowered the far right in Israel, ultra-Orthodox Jews, mostly ultra-Orthodox Jews, that has meant that the Palestinians become progressively hopeless, hemmed in despair, and angry. The equation changed with Hamas's breakthrough of the wall separating Gaza and Israel and massacre of 1,300 or 1,400 Israelis. The realization was, well, containment, yes, can work, but we do have an implacable ideological, theological enemy supported by dozens of thousands of fighters, probably millions of Palestinians who feel hopeless, and clearly, as we've seen through the demonstrations worldwide, hundreds of millions of people. So the government decided, partly through the obligation of having to respond to such a hideous event, and partly through a decision, which is not irrational, but it might be unachievable, that we cannot any longer allow an existential threat, literally on the other side of a wall, indefinitely, to destroy Hamas. That's why. Now, one can certainly challenge many of the premises, the assessments, and conclusions of the Israelis, but the objective is to destroy Hamas. Why also has there been an increase worldwide in sympathy for the Palestinians? I think the answer is clear from the little sketch I gave of the reality just a moment ago for Palestinians in particular. The Palestinians did lose their land in 1948. Now, the Jews were there too, but they did.
The Nakba, which Al Jazeera often talks about and has great documentaries about and which the Palestinians constantly refer to, is a real thing. There is no doubt. And this has been chronicled not just by Palestinians, but by many Israelis, including the likes of Miko Peled, a friend of mine who wrote The General's Son, that Palestinians did lose their land. Some fled, some were pushed out, and it was a tragedy. And over time, certainly, Palestinians have had a rough time, not just in Israel, but in neighboring countries. But over to you, Glenn.
Well, the rough time is not only from the 1948 victory of Jews creating the State of Israel, supported by the nascent United Nations and the British Mandate. Pardon me one second. Pardon my cough. But also because the what we euphemistically refer to as the Arab states, which means Muslim governments surrounding Israel, have not wanted to absorb, from 1948, Palestinians for two reasons or more. If they do, then Israel is the definitive victor. If they do, then the Muslim states, have to deal with millions of angry, disaffected, uprooted Palestinians who are, in particular at present, in recent decades, heavily tinged with the attitudes or ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood, which certainly Egypt and Jordan and Saudi Arabia view as existentially dangerous to the existence of these, what the Muslim Brotherhood considers, apostate, kufr, infidel, secular regimes. So the Muslims wanted to embrace the Palestinians. And just one last sentence, I'm sorry. And the poor Palestinians have been literally stuck, walled in to Gaza and the West Bank with nowhere to go.
Just to your point, Glenn, the challenge for the Palestinians is that even before Hamas came into being, even before the ideology of the Muslim Brotherhood takes off in Gaza, even under Fatah, they had problems in Lebanon. After all, Yasser Arafat was kicked out of Lebanon and sent off, backed off to Morocco, if I remember, or Tunisia, was it?
Tunisia,
Tunisia, to Tunisia. So The point is Palestinians are viewed as a destabilizing force. Jordan, the majority of the population is now Palestinian. We are seeing demonstrations in Amman after Israeli attacks, wherein the entire streets are full of crowds chanting, "We are Hamas." And these chants rise to a crescendo. And when it comes to Shia regimes, such as Syria's Hafez al-Assad, now, of course, it is Bashar al-Assad, his son, they are terrified of Sunni Palestinians coming to Syria because that could inflame the ethnic war that has been going on between the Shias and the Sunnis.
Lebanon has been, at best, a Humpty Dumpty's eggshell, which has been put back together with scotch tape. And it sort of functions, but it's still a broken eggshell because, well, there are many reasons, but the specific one in our lifetimes is that after Tunisia, the Palestine Liberation Organization went, which was much more secular than Hamas, went to Lebanon and continued to attack the Israelis. Israel invaded, and the country has been largely destroyed as a result because of the sectarian Shia, Sunni, Christian, Jewish conflict as a result of the Palestinian presence and the Israeli response. And no Arab Muslim state wants to have what Jordan suffered in the 1970s. Egypt has suffered for decades. Lebanon has suffered as a result. And the poor Palestinians pay the piper of all of that. So I think that really, rather than being historical, is relevant in this, in the context of our presentation, because it explains really the dilemma of the Palestinians, but also why the world, in part, why the world feels such sympathy for their cause. Of course, everyone roots for the underdog and the victim. Israel has a powerful army. The Palestinians are being blown up in their homes and next door to hospitals. They have nowhere to go. They don't have a country. So the attitude will be to support. And frankly, for two reasons, because of the profound, and I'll say it baldly, the profound anti-Semitism of Islam as it has evolved, at the least in our lifetimes. Well, I'm 67. Since the end of the colonial era, becoming much more strongly Islamist as a way to affirm their identity and independence, and taking the most extreme hadith, quotes of Muhammad and quotations of the Quran to justify blaming and killing the Jew, and also of the Christian church, which has spent 2,000 years blaming Jews for Christian frustrations.
So two quick data points to expand more on what you're saying. Number one, the founders of political Islam, people like Sayyid Qutb, Hassan al-Banna, were profoundly anti-Semitic. And they brought from Europe, in some ways, the anti-Semitism tinged by Nazi colors. And of course, the Nazis did encourage this sort of political Islam. And they flirted around with the stupid Grand Mufti of Jerusalem.
It was a way to undercut the Britain's empire. There was an explicit policy of the Nazi intelligence services building upon explicit policies of the former Tsar's intelligence service.
Exactly.
And so we can't blame everything on the Russians and the Nazi intelligence services, but the influence is clear on radical Islam.
That's data point one. And data point two for me is that this is what many Israelis say to me, and indeed many Arabs admit, including Palestinian intellectuals, is that the largely Jewish, or the large Jewish populations that existed all the way from Morocco to Iran, there was a flourishing Jewish community in Baghdad pre-creation of Israel. All that community has had to flee to Israel because once the Ottoman Empire dissolved and once Jews started settling in the Holy Land after the Balfour Declaration of 1917, And of course, once the clashes started occurring, and once things like the Deir Yassin massacre, when Irgun, the fanatical Jewish arm, the other one was the Haganah, which became the IDF, but when Irgun started rising up as an extremist version, and they were doing things like bombing what was that hotel? I'm forgetting.
In Jerusalem, I forget the name of it, but they blew up
King David Hotel.
King David Hotel.
King David Hotel. And so once that started happening, then anti-Semitism, which was already taking off, took off in right earnest in all these young Muslim independent Arab nations, so to speak. They weren't really nation states. They were hodgepodges. And the Jews in these former Ottoman territories fled to Israel, and there was ethnic cleansing of Israelis, which is often ignored. So this is also an important data point to understand the Israeli mindset and the Israeli insecurity. Over to you, Glenn.
So, I mean, explaining the why is implies going through the history, and I think we'll stop there. But and we'll talk about the possible impossibility of the various objectives or perspectives that these Israeli and Palestinian dynamics have led to. I think that's looking ahead of the curve instead of behind, if we can, which is always the job of an intelligence officer, which means the intelligence officer will always fail and make a fool of himself because no one can really predict the future. But that's what we'll do right now.
But as Teddy Roosevelt said, the full marks to the man in the arena who at least makes a fist of it and maybe gets punched in the nose. But
that's
the
right,
blood
that's
and
right.
The sweat and the tears are worth it.
So I talked roughly about the why, and now I will turn to the what. And there are about six whats that I think we need to address. Well, what are Israeli objectives? Those I did mention, at least in part, but there is, pardon me, tremendous questions. The stated Israeli objective is to destroy Hamas. Well, can a conventional military achieve the destruction of an idea? And the answer should be quite clear, no. And if we want practical examples of this, let's only look at Afghanistan for the last 23 years, or 22 years, when the United States invaded to destroy al-Qaeda, a dramatic success. And President Bush, to his credit, in my view, was quite explicit at first, saying, we are not nation building. We are not going to make that mistake again. Laudable objective, immediately jettisoned, because the Americans found that if they left, the Taliban would return to power, and the Taliban would be sympathetic to extremism of Islam in ways that we found a threat, rightly or wrongly. And if we stayed, we could maintain the status quo, a rough stability, slowly frittering away. But in any circumstance, even hundreds of billions of dollars and thousands of American lives over two decades could not fundamentally or quickly enough change the nature of the beliefs in the culture to make it possible for the United States to leave, having achieved what it more fuzzily thought it was pursuing. The same thing would be the case in Palestine.
Just another example, another quick example, because one of our authors, the former Irish Prime Minister John Bruton, worked on the Northern Irish peace process, and he's older even than you. And he makes the point that you cannot destroy an idea. If the Irish Republicans believe that Northern Ireland should unite with Southern Ireland, and they believe fundamentally in using violence, then for all the SAS, the Special Air Service, the SBS, the Special Boat Service, the SRR, the Special Reconnaissance Regiment, for all the extraordinary institutional ability of the British Army, they still couldn't find a military solution to Northern Ireland. Eventually, it took a lot of statesmanship, both in Ireland and in the United Kingdom, and statesmanship on the part of both Protestant and Catholic leaders in Northern Ireland for there to be some semblance of peace.
Yeah. So I think, I believe that the Israeli military can, at some point, it would be able to kill all of the Hamas members it wanted to kill, and destroy all of the, I'll call it, material infrastructure that it wants to destroy. But that at the cost, as we have seen at present, the last I heard is 7,500 Palestinians. I just saw a headline before we came on that apparently some camp has been hit by various strikes, killing hundreds of Palestinians in one strike. Unconfirmed. I don't know if that's true. But in any event, we're up to thousands already. So could the Israelis achieve this without causing such suffering and fury on the part of the Palestinians and the entire world that it would be worthwhile? And that is a pretty tall fence to climb over.
Just to give context to what Israel is doing and to what Glenn you're talking about, I have been reading some reports, and one report says that Israel dropped 6,000 bombs on Gaza in the first 6 days of war. This is far in excess of what the US and its allies did in its counterterrorism campaigns. In Mosul, for instance, the US-led coalition dropped 7,000 bombs over 2 months. So compare 6,000 bombs in 6 days to 7,000 bombs over 2 months. And the order of magnitude is very, very, very different. There are various figures, but one of the things that is important to note that 280,000 people are without homes. Over 10% of Gaza's housing stock has already been destroyed, and this is something that people are estimating from satellite imagery. So the collateral casualties are ridiculously high.
And the Palestinians cannot really be refugees. They have nowhere to go.
Egypt is not going to admit them. They have a tiny sliver of a border with Egypt, with the Sinai Desert, and Egypt has not opened its border crossing. So what we are seeing is that 10% of them already are homeless. Winter is coming. The collateral casualties are very high. And Israel might well win the battle but lose the war.
Now, I mentioned Hamas's objective. I mentioned the proximate or immediate objective of Israel. The long-term objective is to eliminate the ideology. And can the current policy achieve that? Clearly, my implied answer from what I stated about their immediate objectives is no. However, I will say it is conceivable to me that Israel could succeed if, and this is the two-letter word that has, you know, all of the weight in the world, because there are so many contingent implications in it or conditions. If Israel were to clearly state, and here President Biden has been, well, consistent with American policy, but a bit more outspoken about it, to his credit, if Israel were to state, and then do, because it is in their power largely to do, that they will create a two-state solution. They will recognize the independence of a Palestinian state. And if some entity were put in place to replace Hamas, to rule over Gaza, at least. Now, that could be the Palestinian Authority. There are all sorts of almost insurmountable problems with regard to them. They are the entity controlling the West Bank, and they are largely secular but highly discredited. It could be a UN-mandated entity. It could be, probably most likely in my view, an entity created by a consortium of Muslim states. So the Egyptians, the Jordanians, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Turks, whomever, would send contingents and have civil administrators. Then, conceivably, if the Palestinians actually had a future and an independent state, over time, the appeal of the apocalyptic, desperate, but devoted Hamas political theology would not be supported as much. Now, it's important to realize that Hamas has never been particularly popular since it was elected in 2006 or 5. They have imposed their rule at the end of the gun, and anyone who opposes them, they detain or kill. They did it to the Palestinian Authority, their rival for power in Gaza 17 years ago, and they've done it to anyone since. And as always, the demonstrators around the world sympathetic to the Palestinians, I think, reflexively believe, fundamentally is correct, that most Palestinians just want to have a normal life and not be constrained with what they perceive as no future. But you have to have an entity to replace Hamas. It is remotely conceivable, and there's one other if that is required, and that would require, I think, almost certainly the replacement of the Netanyahu government, which means the power of the far right in Israel, the ultra-Orthodox Jews in Israel, who have taken, depending on how you define it, more than 80% of the West Bank from the Palestinians, and have kept the Gazans in their enclave. Only under those conditions could the objectives of Israel and be attained, and of the Palestinians.
Now, Glenn, the challenge with that is that the ultra-Orthodox, the Haredis, are 13% of the population. They have more children. They have a lot of votes. Israel's system is proportional representation. So this means that if you get 13% of the vote, you have 13% of the seats, once you cross a certain threshold. And it's not the first past the post system, which has its own problems. And this means that there's a strong pull structurally for the Israeli government and Israeli politics to lean right. Because remember, 20% of Israel's own population is Arab. So what you're left with is 20 plus 13% is, well, 33%. You're left with then 67%. Of the population, which has to not fracture. So it's a tall ask structurally, the way things are, with Hamas being the way it is and having control over the barrel of the gun, with these Israeli political structures the way they are. Israel is fractured. Israel had massive protests, which we discussed, over judicial reforms. Bibi Netanyahu is a ditherer. He's also incompetent, and he's accused of corruption. In fact, he might well end up in jail after this war is over. So we have actors who are not as tall as David Ben-Gurion on the Israeli side, and actors who are not as tall, certainly even as Yasser Arafat on the Palestinian side. So what are the implications, my question to you is, given the facts on the ground? Well, for Palestinians, for the neighboring states, and for the region.
Yeah, they're all dark. I see a glimmer of light possible from a mansard window above the door, out of reach. But that's the only glimmer that I see. If you know, if the condition, the ifs that I mentioned were to come to pass, or were to be imposed somehow, then there would be a way forward. If not, then the horrors we're seeing might reduce to a simmer, as they have repeatedly for 75 years, but would the embers would continue to burn, and things would flare up again and again. And one has to wonder about the existential future for Israel over time, given the demographics, the political dynamics, and the impossibility, the near suicide that Israeli policies, as in my view, as implemented for the past two decades, imply for the long-term stability of the state. Now, it's possible that the Palestinians simply would end up, as they always have so far, the losers again, utterly hopeless, and continue to lash out in desperation while Israel is fundamentally secure, dealing with bus bombings instead of an existential danger. But I think that we're at a point where the future of Israel is actually more in question than it has been at any time since 1973 or even 1948. I want to talk about, there are three other whats that we must touch upon. We haven't even mentioned the word Iran, the country of Iran. And they are in some ways the big chess player moving the pieces so far. And what Hamas did and what is happening now with Israel's response is, at least so far, a strategic success for Iran. Now, Iran pretty clearly does not seek a regional war. It doesn't want to have the United States military blowing up Iranian proxies or Iranian forces, but it does want to destabilize Israel, and it does want to extend its influence. And Hamas was a proxy, as is Hezbollah in Lebanon, and the immediate success has been the, quote, suspension, unquote, of peace negotiations between Saudi Arabia and Israel, which would bring transformational peace and a whole new future to the Middle East, while probably leaving the Palestinians the losers once again, unless a two-state solution, as President Biden has been starting to say more vehemently, were imposed from without. But Iran has succeeded. That is what Iran's objective is at present, and it is a success to upset Saudi-Israeli negotiations, to destabilize Israel, and to create problems for the United States in the Middle East, ultimately to get the American influence out. So far, the big winners are Iranians. What are Muslim state objectives? Well, we talked about those, really. They pretty well have come to terms with Israel. And I think that it's quite likely there would be and may still be a Saudi-Israeli peace agreement, which would be transformative. But that also implies the Palestinians probably being left out once again, unless somehow, frankly, the U.S. convinces Saudi Arabia to push for the potential solution I mentioned. And then finally, what are the U.S. objectives? And I think I touched upon them in each of the other countries' objectives or people's objectives. And they are really for a two-state solution and to stop the region from blowing up and stop being not be drawn into a regional conflict, which would be catastrophic globally for the United States, for the region, and for countries on the other side of the earth, even.
So, Glenn, as I see it, unfortunately, I don't think that the tide can be stopped, because this conflict is going to weaken Lebanon. This conflict is going to weaken Jordan. Syria is already on thin ice. They've had a civil war. The regime has lost control of its Kurdish areas. It has been propped up by Russia and Iran. Similarly, if we keep going around Egypt seemingly is strong because the military has a strong economy, a strong military economy, and it has managed to keep the Muslim Brotherhood under control. But we should not forget that Morsi was prime minister until recently. And on top of that, the populations could rise up. They could feel inspired by Hamas. If Hamas can take on Israel, if Hamas can rise up against the big Western-backed crusader state, then surely the Arab populations can rise up against their regimes, which are brittle in any case. And this divide between the Arab rulers and the Arab street has never been wider. We can see that through the demonstrations that the Arab states, that the Arab populations are engaging in on their streets, and the rhetoric of the Arab states. So I fear, actually, that we may have crossed a point of no return, and the risks are really too high. I'm not saying it'll all blow up, but the risk is there. In fact, in some ways, the risk is different and lesser And in some ways, the risk is higher than 1973, because in 1973, states attacked Israel.
Right. Right.
Now, the states themselves are brittle and fragile, and we don't know what may happen.
I'm afraid that I have to agree. It's a fraught moment we're all living. There's one more what I want to touch upon, and that is, what is a war crime? Is Israel committing war crimes in its, I'll call it, invasion of Gaza? The general view, widespread view, is yes. Certainly the demonstrators around the world, I think, reflexively would say, well, this is obvious. I actually think that that is incorrect. It doesn't mean that it's not as hideous as everyone is seeing, as we all are seeing, but a military act that causes civilian deaths, if conducted in self-defense and in pursuit of an enemy target, occurs. If innocents are killed unintentionally, it is not, it's a tragedy, but it is not a war crime. Israel's position is pretty justifiable, that they have an implacable foe who wants to kill them all, and their only choice is to respond so as to protect themselves. And I know for a fact, because I've worked with the Israeli military and intelligence, they do try hard not to gratuitously kill civilians. They do. They also recognize, as we all can see, that they killed them. But they are not, as a general policy, they do not conduct vengeance killings out of as punishment, as a rule. Is that occurring under this government? Possibly yes. But I think Israel's position is defendable, as is the horror, outrage, anger, and the view that Israel is conducting war crimes on the part of, I think, most people. And the challenge is that people will die while the lawyers at some point will debate the somewhat subjective issue in a court sometime, be it a moot court or a real one. But I don't think it is really accurate, and this will not be a popular thing to say, I know, to blanket condemn Israel as a war criminal for what it is doing. Hideous as, excessive as, counterproductive as, destructive as Israel's actions are. I'm not necessarily supporting them. I just think the case is not an obvious one to conclude.
I would just add, I'd say that regardless of whether Israel's actions are illegal or unethical, they are certainly unwise. And whilst war crimes may be too strong a word, but they've certainly engaged in illegal settlements in the West Bank.
Absolutely.
Consistently.
Oh, yes.
And constantly. Yeah. And yeah. When you have such settlements, and when you do operations, regardless of how circumspect you may be, regardless of how much you may want to avoid civilian casualties or some abuses, they happen. I served as an officer in insurgency, in counterinsurgency, in highly volatile areas. And things happen when you have men with guns on the streets trying to keep the peace. And the same happened in Northern Ireland. Now, moving on to this technical question about war crimes, and not just technical, I don't mean to underplay this. There is a lot of human suffering. But moving on from that narrower question to a broader one, what happens next for Israel, for the region and for the world? As I see it, very quickly, as I see it, Glenn, and I'll then pass it on to you. Israel has mobilized at least 300,000 men. And at Fair Observer Intelligence, which is our geopolitical and political risk arm, we were thinking about and analyzing, what does this lead to? Now, this is 13% of the male labor force in Israel. So last time Israel had a war in 1973, the Yom Kippur War, which happened 50 years and a day before the terrorist attacks by Hamas. It led to a recession in Israel. It led to major economic problems in Israel. This time, we are convinced that a reduced workforce will lead to lower economic output. And this will certainly, Israel is now called Startup Nation. This is going to affect startups. This is going to affect many of their companies. And it will have a ripple effect outside to all the other companies that rely on these companies in the global complex supply chain that we have of goods and services. So that's one effect I see on Israel itself. On the region, it'll have a negative economic effect because uncertainty is high. Those in the Pentagon like using volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous, VUCA. And now VUCA has certainly shot up. So obviously, Jordan's economy, Lebanon's economy, which is basically in the toilet, that is going to go further down the flush. Arab governments in the region will face intensified street protests and serious political unrest. So there could be an Arab uprisings too. For the world, what we will see is increased interest rates. And of course, certain countries, particularly Israel and others, will have to engage in more borrowing. But these increased interest rates and higher inflation are likely consequence of the uncertainty in this region, although neither Israel nor Palestine have oil and gas, really. It's Qatar and Saudi Arabia, the Gulf, and Iran. Yet the ripple effects of this uncertainty are going to put prices up, oil prices up. So there'll be upward pressure on inflation. There'll be higher inflation, upward pressure on interest rates. There'll be more exchange rate volatility. Those who are running export services businesses will have to deal with potential currency exchange losses and protect themselves from these losses. And on the whole, this conflict will be bad for the global economy. Over to you, Glenn.
Well, those happy notes, what is the risk of, how will this play out? Is, you know, what is the risk of a regional war? And everyone is correct to think that the risks are real, have grown. They will probably continue to grow if Israel continues its invasion of Gaza and its killing of thousands more of Palestinians who are not members of Hamas. And whether a war crime or not, technically, the suffering of the Palestinians is going to infuriate much of the world.
Very quickly, if I can have a word, you know, it doesn't matter if Israel is committing war crimes or not in some ways. If the Arab people, if the Arab street believes it is committing war crimes, and they certainly do. And the opinion in various Arab cities around the region is getting inflamed by every passing day. In fact, Muslim opinion around the world is getting inflamed all the way from Morocco to Malaysia. Even in India, there are very strong expressions of support from the Muslim minority in India. And in fact, India itself is divided. The BJP, the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party, is more pro-Israel, but the opposition refused the Congress Party, which is left-leaning and has supported the Palestinian Liberation Organization in the past, that refused to even condemn the Hamas attacks. So divisions, and of course we know what happened at Glenn's alma mater, Harvard, where students came out and professors came out in support of Hamas in a strange way. One of them even said this needed to happen, off the record, of course, which was shocking to me. But in the court of global public opinion, Israel is taking a beating.
Yeah. Now, the only one of the only quote good unquote, I don't say it with strong irony, but it's a mild irony, I guess, aspects of what's happened so far is that it seems clear that Iran, which is happy about Israel's struggles and trouble for the United States in the region, does not seek a direct conflict with that would bring the United States in, and has encouraged his proxies to make harassing gestures against Israel and the U.S., but also pretty clearly to signal that they don't want a wider war. That's a hard line to follow because it's easy for things to spill over one direction or another. But for now, I think the likelihood of a regional war is has been, as we've all seen, contained. And I think the objectives of the protagonists are to avoid one. So I'm guardedly optimistic that at least the players are not seeking a regional war. I think that probably the Netanyahu government is done for during the fighting or after. I don't know, but I think they're in trouble, and that would be a hopeful sign. Atul has mentioned many of the challenges that the Israeli political system and society have to move beyond the dominance, frankly, of the far right, but his falling is a necessary step. I think it's progressively likely that Hamas, as we have known it, will be destroyed. That doesn't mean the ideology will be, or a reconstituted some entity or other will not come. I think probably one will, but it depends on what entity succeeds the formal control of Gaza and possibly of the West Bank. Those are very tall hurdles to jump over. So I think that it's much easier for all of these steps to go wrong. Everything has to go right for the one small chance of anything good coming out of all of this. But the future is not certain as to what will happen to Gaza, Hamas, Palestine, or Israel. Things are dangerously near to spinning out of control, but there is a glimmer of possibility, although not likely.
So our estimation is that this is the trickiest time for the Middle East since 1973. What happened in the Yom Kippur War in 1973, and that year was also the year of the oil crisis that brought stagflation to the Western economies. And we think 2023, 50 years later, we are in a crisis that is different but has similarities, and risks that are less quantifiable, less measurable, and less understandable. On that merry note, I think it is over for us for now. We look forward to hearing from you. We want to hear suggestions about what topics you'd like us to cover. We've heard back from lots of interested listeners. Yes, we've been irregular. We've been traveling, or rather I've been traveling. I'm in the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. today. Tomorrow, I'll be flying to London via Iceland. But we'll be recording podcasts regularly. And this is all from me, the Rajput.
And the Wasp.
Bye for now.